29. At 1 o'clock that afternoon, Carol Tighe performed, successfully, the pancreas insertion operation on the still-frozen dead Maury Souza. And then, using the tank's most precious medical equipment, the old man's circulation, heartbeat, respiration were artificially, externally restored. The heart began to pump blood, then on its own. And following that, one by one, the artificial function simulators were cautiously and expertly detached from him. The EEG and EKG records during the next critical hours indicated that body processes were occurring normally. Old Souza had a good chance, a very good chance, of recovering and living out a few more good, important years. So that was that. Nicholas, after standing at the bedside of the old mechanic for a long time, watching the monitoring machinery spill out their ribbons of tape, at last turned away, satisfied. It was time at last for him once again to face his little, overcrowded, jammed-together family in their adjoining cubbies, with their shared, quarreled-over daily bathroom. Once more he would resume the old life of the tank. For a while. And then, he said to himself as he walked alone down the clinic corridor into the terminal ramp which led to his own floor, his residential floor, the trumpets shall sound and, not the dead, but the deceived, shall be raised. And not incorruptible, sad to say, but highly mortal, perishable and mad. A nest of hot, scorched wasps rising to attack. This tank first, but by then we will have established contact with our neighboring tanks. We'll have told them, too. Pass it on, we'll say, he said to himself, until everyone knows. And finally, a worldwide network of angry wasps. And if they all swarm simultaneously, no army of leadies can get them. Just some of them. A third, perhaps, but no more. However, it all depended on the TV transmissions during the next 24 hours. What Talbot Yancey, either real or imaginary, had to say to them. He would wait first on that. And which would it be, Bros or Lantano, who at this hour lived and held power, and who had died? The next Yancey speech, the next dose of reading matter, would tell him, probably within the first 10 words uttered by the face on the screen. And which, he asked himself as he arrived at the door of his little cubby, do we want to see emerge? Adams would know better than I. David Lantano was good to me, made it possible for me to obtain the Artiforg. But David Lantano's leadies before that began the act of killing me, would have if the man himself in his older, artificially lighter-skinned Yancey phase hadn't intervened. Or perhaps something else had emerged up there, or will emerge in time. Neither Lantano nor Bros, but a combination. Joseph Adams, as they had worked together to reopen the tunnel, had conjectured about this. A new alignment of Webster Foote and his worldwide police corporation with Louis Runcible and his unwieldy, uneconomic, super-gigantic, overgrown satrapy, pitted against the agency and its army of leadies, many of them wise old tomcats with kinks in their tails, left over from the war and ready at any pretext to fight again, whether commanded by Stanton Bros or David Lantano. He opened the door of his cubby. There sat Rita, composed, waiting. Hi, she said quietly. Hi. He stood awkwardly in the doorway, not knowing whether to enter or not, trying to read her attitude. Rising, Rita said, "It's nice to have you back, to see you. How are you?" She came toward him then, hesitantly, also uncertain, as he was. "You didn't get the bag plague, then. That's what I was most afraid of. From what I've heard and seen on TV and what Dale Nunes said before he disappeared." He put his arms around her, hugged her. "This is fine," Rita said, hugging him fiercely back. "But, Nick, and all points came through just a few seconds ago. We're supposed to be in Wheeling Hall right now, listening to the Protector. But I'm not going. Nunes, as you know, is dead. And so right now there's nobody to make us go. So I'll stay here, with you." She held him against her. However, he very swiftly disengaged her arms. "What is it?" she said, then bewildered. "I'm going to Wheeling Hall," he strode to the door. "What does it matter?" He did not take time to answer. He sprinted down the hall to the ramp. A moment later, with perhaps no more than a fifth or sixth of the citizens of the tank, Nicholas St. James entered Wheeling Hall. Catching sight of Joseph Adams, he made his way over to him, seated himself rapidly beside him. The giant floor-to-ceiling TV screen was lit and active. It pulsed, but showed nothing. Adams briefly said, "We're waiting. There has been what the announcer just now called a delay." His face was pale, stark. He started to appear. Then the image was cut off, as if... He glanced at Nicholas. The coax had been cut. "Jesus," Nicholas said, and felt his heart halt, retrieve its rhythm, at last continue to labor on after a fashion. "So they're still fighting it out." "We'll know," Adams said, speaking coolly, professionally. "It won't be long." His tension seemed deliberately technical, and kept so. Was he at his big oak desk, with the flag behind? Couldn't tell. Too fragmentary. It lasted. They were able to keep it on just a split second. "I think..." Adams' voice was low, but quite clearly audible as, around them, tankers leisurely, with no particular concern, took their seats, yawned, murmured, chatted. They did not know. They just did not know what this meant to them, to their future collective and intimate, personally lived, individual lives. To tell you the truth, the showdown evidently did not come at 9 o'clock a.m. New York time. Apparently, it's just coming now. He examined his watch. It's 6 p.m. at the agency, so something, God knows what, has been going on all day long. He turned his attention back to the big TV screen then, and became silent, waiting. "The dart," Nicholas said, "missed then." "Perhaps, but that wouldn't be the end. Lantano wouldn't give up and die. Let's take this step by step. First of all, that particular weapon assembly, if it fails to meet its target, so notifies its installer owner. So no matter where he may be, say 1,000 miles away, Lantano would know instantly the bad news. And Foote, he'd be up to something in the meantime anyhow. I hope at Cape Town. If he has the brains I know he has, definitely at Cape Town. And would have disclosed to Runcible the whole business about the special project. And remember this. There are, in those conapts of Runcible's, thousands upon thousands of ex-tankers who Runcible might already have trained, armed, prepared for..." He broke off. On the screen appeared the enormous, three-dimensional, full-color, familiar ruddy but tanned, healthy, hard-cut features of Talbot Yancey. "My fellow Americans," Yancey said in his grave and firm, momentous yet considerate, even gracious, voice. "I am humbled before the sight of God to announce to you a matter of such infinite significance that I can only pray to the Almighty and thank Him that we, you and I together, have lived to see this day. My friends," the voice now had choked with emotion, contained, however, by the iron, military-inspired stoicism of the man, masculine always, yet nonetheless overwhelmed. That was Talbot Yancey at this instant, and Nicholas simply could not fathom this that he saw. Was this the simulacrum which had always confronted them from the TV screen, or was this... The camera retreated. Now the oak desk, the flag, as always. Nicholas said to Joseph Adams, "Bros got them before they got him." He felt leaden, dulled. It was over. Well, that was that, and maybe for the better. Who knew? Who would ever know? And still the great, real task lay ahead for him, for all the tankers. Nothing less than a total, absolute war to the end, to try to break through and stay broken through to the Earth's surface. On the screen, in a trembling, overcome voice, Talbot Yancey said, "Today I can inform you, every one of you, down beneath the ground, where you have for so long labored, year in, year out." Adams grated, "Get to it. Without complaint, enduring and suffering and always having faith. Now, my friends, that faith, which has so long been tested, can be justified. The war, my friends, is over." After a moment, Wheeling Hall and the people scattered here and there in it were dead still. Nicholas turned. He and Adams looked at each other. "And soon, my friends," Yancey continued in his heavy, solemn way, "you shall come up to your own sunlit world once again. You will be shocked at first by what you see. It will not be easy, and this will be slow, I must tell you, slow in coming. It must be done bit by bit. But it is here now. All fighting has ceased. The Soviet Union, Cuba, all members of PAC-PEEP, has, as an entity, resigned itself, agreed at last to... Lantano, Adams said unbelievingly. Getting to his feet, Nicholas walked up the aisle, out of Wheeling Hall. In the corridor, alone, he stood in silence, thinking. Evidently Lantano, with or without Webster Foote, had, after all, gotten Bros, either early in the morning with the high-velocity dart, or if not then, and by that weapon, later on, and in some other but absolutely professional, equally serviceable way, aimed of necessity at the old brain itself, because that alone could not be replaced. When that organ was gone, it was over. And it is over. Bros, he realized, is dead. There is no doubt of it. This was the proof, what we were waiting for. The one, the only sign we down here would receive. The reign of the Yantsmen, the fraud of 13 years, or 43 if you start with Fisher's documentaries, all over. For better or worse. Appearing beside him, Adams stood for a moment. Neither of them spoke. And then Adams said, "It all depends on Runcible and Foote at this point. Maybe they can drag Lantano into a stalemate, moderate him, what in the old U.S. government was called balance of power, possibly through an appearance before the Recon Dis-N Council. Insist on..." He gestured. "God knows. I hope they do. It's a mess, Nick. Honest to God. I know, without being up there and seeing, it's a terrible mess, and it'll be a mess for a long time." "But," Nicholas said, "we're going to start emerging." Adams said, "What I'm waiting to see is how Lantano, or whoever it is that's running the simulacrum now, or however they're transmitting, I want to see how they explain those thousands of miles of grass and trees, instead of an endless waste surface of radioactive rubble." He grinned, grimaced, twitched rapidly. Half a dozen, then steadily, deeper, stronger, and more profound, conflicting ideas and emotions flew across his features as, in his mind, he saw swiftly into one possibility after another. The idea man, the Yance man in him, the person that he was, came under these conditions, the excitement, the fear and stress, back into being. "What the hell," he said, "can they, whoever they are, possibly say? Could there be a plausible cover story? Lord, I can't think of one. Anyhow, right now, right on the spot. Lantano, though. You have no realization, Nick. He might. He's brilliant. Yes, he very possibly might." "You think," Nicholas said, "that the biggest lie is still to come?" After a long, visibly tormented pause, Adams said, "Yes." "They can't just tell the truth?" "The what?" "Listen, Nick. Whoever they are, whatever combination out of all the possible crazy bedfellow, conniving, double-dealing deals and deal-outs, whatever group or person has gotten its paws, temporarily anyhow, on the winning cards after this long day of whatever took place, they have a job, Nick. They have the job now of explaining away an entire planet of green, neatly trimmed, Letty Gardner cared-for park. This is it. And not just satisfactorily explaining it to you or me or a couple of ex-tankers here or there, but to hundreds and hundreds of millions of hostile, really furious skeptics who are going to scrutinize every single word that ever issues out of a TV set by anybody from this moment forever into the future. Would you like that job, Nick? Just exactly how well would you like to have to do that?" "I wouldn't," Nicholas said. Adams said, "I would." His face writhed in suffering, and with what seemed to Nicholas an authentic and unmistakable, devouring yearning. "I wish to God I were in on it. I wish I were sitting in my office at the agency right now at 580 Fifth Avenue, New York, monitoring this transmission as it goes out over the coax. It's my job. Was my job. But the fog scared me. The loneliness. I let it get me. But I could go back now and it wouldn't get me. I wouldn't let it. Because this is so important. We were working up to this all the time, this moment when we had to account for it all. Even if we didn't know, it added up to this, and I'm not there. Now that this moment's finally come, I'm off in hiding. I ran. His suffering, the sense of loss, the knowing he was severed from them, and it palpably grew, made him gag, as if he had been brutally butted in the depths of his stomach, as if physically thrust back so that now he was falling, and helplessly with nothing to cling to. Adams caught at the empty air, flailing, futile, and yet still he was trying. "It's over," Nicholas said to him, and not trying or wanting to be kind. "Over for you personally and over for all of them. Because," he said to himself, "I'm going to tell them the truth." They looked at each other silently, Adams blinking out of the recess into which he fell and fell, both of them without friendliness and utterly without warmth, divided, each from the other, absolutely. And second by second the hollowness, the space between, enlarged, until finally even Nicholas felt it. Felt the grip of what Joseph Adams had always called the fog, the inner, soundless fog. "Okay," Adams gasped. "You blab the truth. You rig up some dinky little 10-watt shortwave radio transmitter and raise the next tank. Pass your word along. But I'm going back up to my domain, and I'm going to hole up in my library where I have to be right now and write a speech. Beyond doubt, without qualifications, the best one I ever did in all my years. The culmination. Because that's what we need. Even better than Lantano can do. When I really have to, I can surpass even him. There isn't anyone who can get beyond me at my job. I know I have it. So we'll see, Nick. We'll wait a while and see who wins. Who believes what and whom, when all this is finally over. You have your chance, and I'm not going to let mine slip by. I'm not going to be left discarded." He stared at Nicholas. Rita, breathless and excited, hurried up the hall to her husband. "Nicholas, I just heard. The war is over and we're going to be able to go back up. We can finally start to..."
"But not quite yet," Nicholas said. "They haven't quite got it ready. Conditions on the surface aren't quite right yet." He returned Adam's fixed, goaded, suffering stare. "Are they?"
"No, not yet," Adam said, in slow, mechanical response, as if he had already gone, and little, very little of him remained here now by which to answer. "But conditions will be," he said. "Like you said, okay, in time."
"But it's true," Rita said, gasping. "We won. They, Pak Peep, they surrendered to our armies of Letties. Yancey said so. It was piped to every cubby in the tank. I heard it down below."
Seeing the expression on her husband's face, she said falteringly, "It's not just a rumor. Yancey himself, the protector, personally said it."
To Adams, Nicholas said, "What about this? You could tell them, tell us, that it's a surprise for our birthday."
"No," Adams said vigorously, thinking once more at high speed, weighing each of Nicholas' words. "Not good enough. It won't do."
"The radiation level," Nicholas said.
He felt tired. But not too tired, considering, and not too pessimistic, not by any manner of means despairing. Despite what both he and Adams saw, the task, which had step by step approached unnoticed all of these waiting and for each of them unproductive years.
"The radioactivity," Nicholas said. At that, Adams' eyes flickered intensely.
"The radioactivity," Nicholas said, "has just now, finally, after all this time, at last dropped to a tolerable level."
"There it is. What about that?"
"And throughout all these years you were forced to say you had no choice, just no choice at all in the matter. It was morally and practically necessary to say that the war was still going on, or otherwise people, and you know how they always do, would have rushed to the surface."
"Foolishly," Adams agreed, nodding slowly.
"Too soon," Nicholas said. "The way they naturally act in their stupidity, and the radiation, it would have killed them. So actually, when you get right down to it, this was self-sacrificing, the sort of moral responsibility that your leadership entailed. How about that?"
"I know," Adams said quietly, "that we can come up with something."
Nicholas said, "I know you can, too. Except for that one thing," he said to himself, and put his arm around his wife to draw her closer.
"You're not going to, because we will not allow you."